Hello, this is the Musical Movie Critic. I'm here to talk about Fantasia 2000, the 60-year removed sequel or follow-up or continuation of Walt Disney's 1940 masterpiece Fantasia. The idea of continuing Fantasia is a great idea because it exposes new generations to classical music they may not have heard. And I'm going to go over in the next hour and 15 minutes basically just why I think that this movie should be looked at as a worthy successor, and like its predecessor, one of the finest pieces of animation ever. Not going to go into too much as far as the techniques. If you want to learn about that, I mean, I recommend buying the DVD or at least renting the DVD. Although if you are listening to this, you probably have already. We're about to start off with the Beethoven's Fifth, probably the most inspired choice to start off the piece. It's because it is the most, as they mentioned, probably the most memorable opening in all of music, classical music. The segment in particular is not as abstract as I think they wanted it to be, and it's certainly not as abstract as and the Toccata and Fugue, but just the idea of using pure music, I think, was the whole point. And just seeing what came out of that from the directors and the artists. And what comes out, you know, it's a fun little piece. You know, I'm sure a lot of kids get a kick out of it. I mean, you know, personally, you know, I would have liked to have seen it be a little more experimental, a little more abstract, but damn, does it look good. It looks really quite spectacular. Love the colors, love the colorations. In that case, it really is a worthy companion to the Toccata and Fugue. Have the little butterfly nets. And, you know, I mean, I think for what it's worth, for given the story, I mean, it really does capture, based on the music, it really does capture the emotional highs and lows and dramatic intensity, I think, of the music quite well. I mean, it's mostly about color, it's mostly about sort of an abstract form. It's not linear storytelling by any stretch of the imagination. It's not like some of the other segments that we'll go into. It's just something, it's basically just a way to get the anthology started on something on a high note, and I think it does that quite well. I mean, is it necessarily, like I said, it's not as experimental as I probably would like to have seen. I would have liked to have seen go for something a little more daring. But it's an entertaining piece of animation nonetheless, and I think it's something that holds up really well and will continue to hold up. It illustrates one point that I want to make as we go on in this, and that basically how the aesthetic of what we recognize as Disney has changed in the past 60 years, and it has changed. Anybody who doesn't realize that, you're not paying attention, because they have the aesthetic of what Disney animation is has changed over the past 60 years. And this, I mean, this is a good way to open it, I think. Here we are, first interstitial. Admittedly, I'm not a huge fan of these interstitials, and it seems like it's the one thing that most people kind of agree are not that great. Personally, I do prefer the Dean Staler narration. I think there are some of these that don't really have the elegance, certainly, or the reverence towards the music that the Dean Staler interstitials in the original Fantasia had. I mean, they work in the sense of how they're supposed to work, which is sort of give you some time to breathe between the segments, sort of collect your thoughts, what you thought of that, sort of give you some insights of what you're about to hear. You know, and Steve Martin's always a pleasure. You know, can't really complain too much about seeing him. Same with Itzhak Perlman, the great violinist, who's here to give us a little thing on Pines of Rome, which is coming up, and certainly one of the top two or three segments in this one, I think, at least as far as the new segments go. James Levine, conductor, Chicago Symphony. Funny, they recorded this music with the Chicago Symphony in Medina Hall. I was in band in high school, and actually in one of the symphonic bands at my high school, went up to a concert band festival in Chicago that played at the Medina Hall, which is the exact same place where they record music for Fantasia 2000. When I first heard that, I was really excited because of the fact that it's like, yeah, I played there. And, I mean, it's just, from a recording standpoint, such a great place to play at. I mean, like I think Levine says in one of the documentaries, in the documentary on Fantasia 2000, it's not exactly the best place for a live concert, but if you listen to a recording there, just from there, it's just absolutely spectacular. So we're into Pines of Rome now, which is certainly one of my favorite segments. I really love it. Admittedly, when I first saw it on the IMAX, I saw it a couple of times on IMAX. Then I saw it once on the normal 35 normal movie theater. Then I saw it a couple more times on IMAX. They actually re-released it. So I saw it 5 times in all, and it seems like when I first saw this one, the animation, the character animation with the whales and the background animation didn't really feel right. But, I mean, the more I've seen it, the more it's like, you know, I mean, this works. I think it's because of the fact that IMAX is just such a huge screen that it's like, I mean, you know, you see more of it. You really do see more of it, more of a movie than you will see on a 35mm screen, on normal movie theater screen. You know, I mean, I love the fact that it's like they acknowledge the fact that, you know, this was music that was more than like, that was written more as a reference to like ancient Rome, not necessarily whales flying, but you know what, it's really a thing of beauty. I mean, it's really a wonderful, it's really a wonderful piece of animation. I mean, just absolutely beautiful. You know, I mean, and upcoming, we're coming to one of these parks that just is really sort of disarming in terms of how moving it is compared to probably how it should be. It probably should not be as resonant as it is, but the combination of the what's going on in the story with the absolutely remarkable visuals, and then the music. The music is what makes this as powerful as it is. I mean, you know, it's a sense of melancholy. You know, you wonder what's going to happen. You're not quite sure what's going to happen. You sort of feel for this whale, which is quite surprising. At least that's how I look at it. And Disney's one of the best. Disney knows how to tell a story, for the most part. I mean, if they have a story worth telling, they know how to tell a story. And most of the time, they do have a story worth telling. And this is an example. I mean, such an imaginative, fully, you know, partially realized story. I mean, you could probably make an entire feature just based simply on these whales. Actually, hint, might be a good idea for Disney. You know, because I guess, according to their little booklet on Fantasia 2000, there's a series of tone poems that Respighi composed about Rome. Might be interesting to see if they, you know, when coupled with this, you know, take on the other pieces and see what you can come up with. Might be an interesting little idea. I'd probably pay to see it. I would pay to see it. Just looking at this, I mean, that'd be a great idea, I think. You know, or maybe they could, you know, do something in hopefully another Fantasia down the line. This is, I mean, Fantasia and Fantasia 2000 are basically, you know, they sort of don't really get enough cred in this department, because what they do is they basically, you have the music and then you set the animation to music. You set the story, you tell the story by what the music dictates. It's not the other way around. It's a lot like what Kubrick did with the Blue Danube in 2001. I mean, he's gotten a lot of credit over the years for that, and it's a masterful conceit, especially in that context. But, you know, I mean, he gets all the credit for it, but bottom line is, he wasn't the first one to do it. I mean, Walt Disney was the first one to do it with Fantasia, and this is just a continuation of that idea. It's a good idea. I hope they do continue to make more Fantasias down the road. You know, there's such a wealth of classical music that's out there. And, I mean, not necessarily just do classical music, do other genres, you know? I mean, don't necessarily turn it into, you know, one of the things is, I mean, the idea of saying music to images is not exactly, it's not exactly a novelty of an idea nowadays. I mean, it's, you know, it's done all the time in music videos, which has sort of cheapened the effect of it, and I think is part of the reason why people didn't respond to this one as much as I think they probably should have, and probably as much as they did for the original Fantasia, because, I mean, by now, it's basically old hat, the idea of seeing music set to images. I mean, music videos have been doing it for 20-some-odd years. So, Dwayne, probably nearly 30 years. So, but I think there's a distinct difference between what people do in music videos with what Disney's doing with Fantasia. I mean, they're paying complete reverence to the music. It's about the music as much as it is the images. I mean, I think in terms of a lot of the music videos I've seen, a lot of the lesser music videos I've seen, it seems like it's more about, you know, it's more of a marketing ploy. Here, you don't really get that feeling. You really get the feeling that there's a passion that comes into here. It's not the case with every music video, but it's something that comes through more strongly here, and especially in this part, which is probably one of my three favorite moments in the entire movie. I'll mention them. This is one of them. There's a certain amount of transcendence, and actually I was thinking, watched this movie recently, and I sort of thinking that this is actually very, this could almost be seen as an homage directly or indirectly to the very end of 2001, which, if you haven't seen that movie, I won't spoil it. If you have, you know what happens. A certain sort of elevation from one type of plane of existence to another, and that's sort of the idea, I think, behind this. You know, the fact that they can fly, you know. We know, obviously, in real life, whales can't fly, but this is fantasy, plain and simple. And, you know, I know one of the things they were trying to do with this was they wanted to make sure that the opening had that sort of abstract feel with, like, the Toccata and Fugue in the original Fantasia, which, like I've said, they kind of did. And then you have the ending, which is sort of the sacred and profane, which kind of did, which they definitely did, I think, in terms of Firebird, but I'll talk about that later. But at the same time, it's sort of what they do with this piece is sort of like what they do in the Nutcracker. They don't use the intended story and come up with something completely different, completely out of the blue, and something that resonates quite powerfully, I think. If you think about it, I mean, and seeing this on IMAX especially, and seeing it on the big screen in general, I mean, there's, you just get a sense of almost a transcendence that just is supersedes anything. It's the marriage of music and animation and first-rate animation, I should say, at its finest. Really beautiful segment, one of my favorites in terms of the Fantasia movies. Right here is probably one of the better interstitials, the one with Quincy Jones and Ralph Gershon, who plays the piano in Rhapsody in Blue. Nice choice of Quincy Jones, and brilliant choice of music. And I love the idea that it's sort of set in space. I love it. I mean, it gives you the sense right off the bat when you see the stage sort of forming. I mean, obviously, you know, it's CG, but also you get the feeling that there's going to be a sense this is going to be something different, going to be something special. And I think you get that. I think you get that throughout this movie. Especially in this segment right here. This is probably my second favorite piece of Fantasia 2000, the Rhapsody in Blue. I saw this for the first time, and I heard the music. I love the music. I actually had the soundtrack before I saw the movie. I got it around Christmas. I saw it in the theater. Saw it in a record store, and I'm like, hey, you know what? This would be cool to get. And I ended up getting it, and I didn't actually, unfortunately, never got to see the movie until, like, April. And by that time, it was, like, a couple weeks from leaving the theater. But it was well worth seeing. I'm glad I got a chance to see it. And one of my favorites. I just love the colors in this. I mean, the colorations in all of these segments are just absolutely beautiful. Here, I think, in particular, is quite striking. You sort of get this. I mean, the background, you know, you get the feeling, I mean, you know, if you know the piece was written around the 20s and, you know, early part of this century, you know, it's an American work, you know, it's, and you get the idea that this is set during the Depression early on. Just want to say, though, before I get on with that, that this cat actually kind of reminds me of one of our cat's music. We've got Black and White Cat, too. And now here, the cat sort of looks like one, sort of, at least to me, it's been a while since I've seen the movie, but it sort of reminds me of one of the Siamese cats from Lady and the Tramp. I don't know why, but I think that one expression after she brushes off the milk, sort of fluffs off the milk. I love the way the Goldbergs here just sort of, I mean, they really do a good job. I mean, the music basically dictates what they could do, and, you know, that's more of a credit to Gershwin, but it's credit to Eric Goldberg, the director, and all of the directors on the Fantasia movies, that they can see that. They can see, okay, here's where something, you know, clever can happen in the background, just something off hand, and this is where it's supposed to be melancholy. And that's one of the things I was going to touch on before I talked about the cat, was, you know, the way they color this, the fact that, you know, you got these blues and purples, the fact that you set up, the fact that sort of during the Depression, there is a sense of melancholy that goes on throughout most of this piece, and is actually, you know, I mean, I'm sure there have been other pieces of animation that have sort of maybe looked as good, if not more so, but I mean, this is, at least as far as Disney is concerned, one of the most unique pieces of animation I've seen the studio do. I mean, it is a credit to the directors that they can listen to this music and hear, like, okay, here's where something funny can happen. Here's where something sad's supposed to happen. Here's, you know, they really just get into listening to the music on a purely cerebral level and just sort of get their own interpretation of what they think the composer intended, might have intended. This is just some beautiful animation. I'm just watching this and I love it. I love this. And, you know, the fact that they were, I mean, it's the perfect combination of style of animation and the music. I mean, the fact that they were inspired by Al Hirschfeld, the fact that they brought him in on the project, and the fact that they were able to make it work with the music is one of the best qualities of this. This particular segment. I think Gershwin would be proud if he saw this. I think he'd be pleased with the way his music was treated. Really treated quite respectfully. I don't know what we're speaking. Beethoven would have thought, and obviously I don't, but I think Gershwin probably would have been pleased. This is nice interpretation of his music, nice story to go along with his music. It's a pleasure listening to the technical commentary for this movie this segment, because of the fact that not only do you get the Goldbergs, the director and art director respectively, on this segment, but you also get to hear from Al Hirschfeld, and it's really just a pleasure, the fact that he was so involved with this that, you know, you could actually get him in on a commentary and it would make sense. And who are we about to see? Funny. Piece is composing itself before its eyes. before our eyes. Such a great choice. I mean, it does sort of seem out of place given the nature of a lot of the other segments here, but it's, you know what? I mean, who cares? It just works with it. It works as its own self. I mean, that's one of the things. I mean, you know, that's one of the things. The original Fantasia, I mean, there was no probably was not necessarily a sense of, well, what would go well together, because, I mean, there are some that probably wouldn't necessarily go together in that film, or you expect to go together. But, I mean, you know, it's basically, what do we want to do? What pieces did we want to showcase in this one? And they picked a good selection. I know I hadn't heard a few of the pieces that were part of this before, so it was really, really quite a treat to get introduced to those pieces, you know, like the Pines of Rome. I had heard parts of Rhapsody in Blue, but I didn't exactly know the piece. The Firebird, which we'll talk about later, and the other ones. This year, what we're seeing right now is, again, one of my favorite moments in the movie. I'd say there were like three moments I just absolutely loved. This is another one. This is one of those that I think just really where the emotions brought into play in here just work exceptionally well. And it's a credit to the music and the animators that they come through as well as they do. I just love the fact that it's like you get to see into each of these people's dreams. They've been hinted at, but you get to see them just fully blossom. And of course, this will bring us into the home stretch, basically, of this piece, where we get to see how they make these dreams a reality.
Is this necessarily the best animation we've seen of late? Probably not. I don't know.
There are some other showcases of animation that are as good and better, but, you know, the fact of the matter is, I believe it was, like somebody said in the documentary for Fantasia 2000, this is really nothing more than a showcase of sort of experiments in animation, sort of freeform experiments in animation. I mean, that's what Fantasia is. It's a freeform of music, and that's what these movies are, Fantasia and Fantasia 2000. They're freeforms. Do they necessarily make stylistic sense? No. Do they work well together? I think so. You know. This was definitely one of my favorite movies to watch in 2000. It was probably my favorite one. I really love seeing this on IMAX. It was such a wonderful experience, one of the most memorable movie-going experiences of my life. Just really enjoyable, and so I'd never seen animation on IMAX before. I had seen other IMAX films, but nothing quite like this. And you know, that's. And this was a great ushering in of Disney re-releasing some of its modern classics on IMAX. You know, they've done it with Beauty and the Beast and Lion King. You know, you really see in watching this on the big on IMAX on that screen the potential for a great visual and audio experience. And I mean, you know, it's very fitting that they chose IMAX. I mean, you know, because the first one is as well known for its technical achievements, the use of stereo sound and the presentation, as much as it is for the film itself. And it was a fitting tribute to release this in IMAX, because that's about the most experimental thing you could pretty much do nowadays is try for an IMAX presentation, IMAX design film. Great ending scenes or Times Square. Now, this upcoming interstitial with Bette Midler, I'm ashamed to say that I actually thought they were kind of joking in a lot of these, because of the fact that it's like, you know, up until now, it's like when you have like the celebrities like Bette Midler and Steve Martin, these were, you know, this segments were less serious than they were with like Quincy Jones. But Ride of the Valkyries really is a Fantasia idea that didn't exactly pan out. You get to see a bit of it on the Bug Ballet, Baby Ballet. That's a real one. Those are real ones. I assume that one's real. I'm not sure about the Dolly one. That would be odd, but
Yeah. If you don't have it, if you're a fan of this movie or the original Fantasia or both, you have to absolutely own the Fantasia Anthology DVD set. It's one of my favorite DVD sets. It's one of the first DVDs I actually bought when we first got our DVD player in 2000, because I was really on a kick about this movie. I really loved this movie when I first saw it. And, just such an experience. It's like, and I had heard about the Fantasia Anthology box set and just had to have it. It was like the third DVD purchase I made. It was the first box set. Right now we're watching The Steadfast Tin Soldier with the Shostakovich Piano Concerto number 2. A very lucky combination. They knew they had a story they wanted to tell, but what music goes with it? This piano concerto is perfect for this story. I really do think so. I mean, you can really have a lot of fun with it, and it, you know, one of the things is, I mean, it's entertaining, but it's dramatic, and it's everything the segments we've seen before are up to. Now, I read at least one review where somebody complained that it's like this was sort of like not nearly as impressive as Toy Story was. But I really have to call foul on that because of the fact that this isn't supposed to be Toy Story. This is supposed to be a fairy tale. This isn't supposed to, you know, and these aren't new, sleek, shiny toys like they are in the Toy Story movies. These are, you know, toys from actually, I believe, probably the 19th century is the time this story is based in, I guess. At least, I would imagine the 19th century at least. So, I mean, these are older toys. They're not exactly new toys. They're not supposed to look like Buzz Lightyear or even Woody, for that matter. I mean, they're supposed to have a certain texture and feel to them, and I think you really get that. And plus, I mean, you have to realize, I mean, these are hand-drawn backgrounds. I mean, it's basically just the characters that are CG. And, you know, Pixar didn't do this. You know, Disney did. And Disney did a great job in animating it. I mean, the look fits for the story, I think. The look fits completely. You know, I mean, for the most part, Pixar really advanced the form to the point where, I mean, you know, they've really made it look very photorealistic. You know, they're one of the ones that made it as photorealistic. I mean, all you have to do is, I mean, look at Knick Knack. Look at some of the shorts they did earlier. You know, some of the early shorts they did. I mean, they're great shorts, great animation and all that. But, I mean, you know, this is sort of an evolving... This short comes off... I mean, it was released after Toy Story 2, by which point the animation is... CG animation had just gotten drastically different. Drastically improved, but, I mean, this is sort of one of the... Not necessarily a stepping stone in the... But it's something that... You know, shows that this photorealism that we kind of have started to take for granted, I think, CG animation, really, you know, it came from somewhere, and this is, you know, and I think this is a good, it's a nice companion piece to Toy Story. I mean, you know, is it probably as good of a story as Toy Story? I don't know. I mean, probably not. It's not necessarily as good of animation as Toy Story, but, you know, there's a unique charm to this that really works. There's sort of an old-fashioned charm to the look of the toys and look of the, you know, the rats and the fish and all this stuff. I mean, just accept the fact that it's not Toy Story, that you're not seeing Pixar here, you're seeing Disney, and, you know, I think they do a good job. I just really do think they do a good job, and it works for the story, which I think is the most important thing. You know, I can't necessarily see this being told with the type of clarity we see a Toy Story. I can't really see this story in that. I mean, I don't think it would necessarily fit. I think it would probably almost look worse because of the fact that I mean, you know, this isn't modern day America. This is like 19th century, I don't know, London, probably, England, 19th century England, maybe America, but, you know, it wouldn't work. I don't think it would work if it were done. If it were done any other way in terms of the animation, you know.